country, Donald Trump wrote on his Truth social platform. Despite Donald Trump's role in the 6th of January 2021 attack on the Capitol and his repeated false assertions that the 2020 election was stolen from him, a number of Republicans on Capitol Hill are already endorsing his presidential bid. Hakeem Jeffries on Friday took a shot at those GOP lawmakers, suggesting they are complicit in any violence that stems from Donald Trump's remarks. It is also very unfortunate that the extreme MAGA Republicans in the House of Representatives continue to back Donald Trump and his reckless and his violent and his hateful and his disgusting rhetoric, Hakeem Jeffries said. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered this story. Donald Trump's incendiary rhetoric over his expected indictment in New York could get someone killed, the Democratic leader in the U.S. House of Representatives has warned. The twice-impeached former president's rhetoric is reckless, reprehensible, and irresponsible, Hakeem Jeffries from New York told reporters at the Capitol in Washington. It is dangerous, and if he keeps it up, he's going to get someone killed. Donald Trump faces indictment in a Manhattan investigation of a hush money payment to the film star Stormy Daniels. Stormy Daniels claims an affair, which Donald Trump denies. Trump's former lawyer and fixer, Michael Cohen, served jail time after admitting making the payment shortly before the presidential election in 2016, then being reimbursed by Donald Trump when Trump became president. Trump first denied, then admitted the payment. Michael Cohen is now a key witness in the Manhattan case against Donald Trump. Trump claims the Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg is politically and racially motivated. Alvin Bragg, a Democrat and the first black man to fill the prestigious post, is believed to be considering charges including falsification of business records, campaign finance violations, and tax fraud. Donald Trump has falsely predicted his own arrest, mused on wanting to be seen handcuffed, and called for supporters to protest. Security preparations have been made around the courthouse in Lower Manhattan, but no serious protest has taken place. On Thursday, 23rd of March, Donald Trump upped the ante, using his Truth social platform to post a composite picture of himself wielding a baseball bat next to Alvin Bragg. Norm Eisen, a former White House ethics czar, now a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, responded by saying, "Threatening a prosecutor is a crime in New York, in fact, multiple crimes. Harassment in the first degree, menacing in the second degree, stalking in the fourth or third degree, and that's just for starters." But Trump kept going. Early on Friday, he claimed potential death and destruction in such a false charge could be catastrophic for our country. Donald Trump also called Alvin Bragg a degenerate psychopath that truly hates the United States. Earlier this week, bomb threats were made in Lower Manhattan. It was not clear if they were related to the Trump payment case, though one of the threats forced the postponement of a hearing related to a separate court case involving the former president. British newspaper The Independent has also covered this story. The top Democratic lawmaker in the House of Representatives has excoriated Donald Trump for his late-night warning on his Truth Social platform, claiming that death and destruction potentially awaits the United States if he is criminally prosecuted. The former president's increasingly incendiary rhetoric is reckless, reprehensible, and irresponsible, House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries said in a press conference on 24th of March. "It is dangerous, and if he keeps it up, he's going to get someone killed," Hakeem Jeffries said. "We're already seeing the consequences of incitement from the former president. He's principally responsible for inciting the violent insurrection on the Capitol that happened on 6th of January 2021. But clearly, he has not learned his lessons." Donald Trump's increasingly volatile remarks surrounding his potential criminal indictment and the 2024 presidential campaign have accelerated in recent days after he predicted his own arrest, demanded his supporters protest on his behalf, and described the country as a dying and third world nation where leftist thugs are killing and burning with no retribution. Donald Trump's latest comments arrived before his rally in Waco, Texas, the first of his 2024 campaign. He has repeatedly lashed out at New York County District Attorney Alvin Bragg, whose office is leading a criminal probe into the former president, describing the prosecutor as a degenerate psychopath and a danger to America. Republican officials rushed to Donald Trump's defense after Trump falsely announced on 18th of March that he would be imminently arrested in a case stemming from the hush money payment to an adult film star in 2016. Republican leaders of several House committees also demanded that Alvin Bragg testify to Congress about his unprecedented abuse of prosecutorial authority. An indictment has not been issued, and Republicans have not reviewed evidence considered by the grand jury that is hearing the case. It's also very unfortunate that the extreme MAGA Republicans in the House continue to back President Trump and his reckless and his violent and his hateful and disgusting rhetoric, Hakeem Jeffries said on 24th of March.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Under mounting pressure from weeks-long protests, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has finally accepted to delay his infamous judicial reforms plan.
Therefore, out of national responsibility, out of the will to prevent the rift in the nation, I have decided to suspend the second and third readings of the law in this term of the Knesset in order to allow the time to reach that wide consensus ahead of legislation during the next Knesset.
Before the announcement, Israel's Army Chief of Staff called on the regime's forces to continue to do their duty in the face of bitter divisions over the judicial plan. That's amid reports of many Israeli reservists threatening not to serve while hundreds have already skipped reserve duties. Meanwhile, the Israeli regime's embassies in other countries and major ports across the occupied territories joined massive strikes against the reforms. Hundreds of thousands of Israelis have protested over a planned overhaul of the judiciary. The reforms are backed by Prime Minister Netanyahu and his pro-settler coalition and would enable them to pick elect judges and limit Supreme Court's power to strike down laws. Lawmakers have already passed a reform that strips the Attorney General of the power to declare the Prime Minister unfit for office. Critics say the plans for judicial reform will weaken democracy. Israel has no written constitution, so the Supreme Court should be a vital check on the cabinet, but the court's track record on Palestinian rights is already weak. Israel's Supreme Court entrenches the occupation and upholds laws blocking Palestinians' equal rights. It has never ruled out the legality of hundreds of Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank, which are illegal under international law. Over 6 million Palestinians live under Israeli occupation and draconian military law. Palestinian citizens have inferior rights, face unequal laws, and are banned from living in 900 towns. Also, Israel's far-right cabinet banned Palestinian flags and threatened to wipe out Palestinian villages and wants more illegal settlements on their land. That's while Israel is considered an apartheid regime by leading rights groups due to its systematic denial of the rights of Palestinians. For many, the far-right Israeli cabinet's plans to weaken the judiciary and entrench the prime minister's power are just another extension of occupation and unequal treatment. Netanyahu's proposed reforms seek to rob the Israeli Supreme Court of the power to overrule decisions made by the regime's new extremist cabinet and the Knesset. Mass protests have gripped the regime since it announced the plan in January. Tens of thousands of demonstrators have faced off police in the streets for the past 12 weeks. In reaction to the ongoing crisis, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani has described the situation as a wildfire that is consuming Israel from within. He added that the attempt by Netanyahu to boost his own power has once again revealed internal fault lines in the Zionist society by stoking unprecedented street protests and clashes. According to the latest surveys, Israelis' trust in institutions has been deteriorating for some years, with only 35% of people saying they trusted the institutions quite a lot or very much in 2022.
To be honest, it's incredible. I can't believe what's going on in Israel. It's just madness. It's complete madness. All the authorities, all the people that have the from all the jurisdictions, from the militaries, from the financial sectors, from all the sectors in Israel, saying that this. Reform or whatever you call it, it is completely crazy, and Israel has become a very dangerous place to be in at the moment.
Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani also took Israel's Western allies, especially the US and the UK, to task for their continued support for Israel. He said it's ridiculous that the United States and Europe, especially Britain, continue to support a fake identity which is based on occupation and apartheid and use democracy as justification.
The political rift between the East and the West continues to broaden day after day. That can be clearly seen in the recent comments made by Russian President Vladimir Putin. In an interview with the Russian media, President Putin accused the United States and NATO of seeking to build a new global axis. Putin said the Union bore some resemblance to the World War II alliance between Nazi Germany, Fascist Italy, and Imperial Japan. The Russian president also criticized Washington for its double standards and its own action in forming several military alliances. He named Australia, New Zealand, and South Korea as being in line to join what he termed as a global NATO.
They are announcing that they will create global NATO. What's that? Great Britain and Japan at the start of this year, in January, I think, have signed an agreement on developing relations and mutual development in military area.
The remarks by Putin come days after he and his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping met in Moscow to discuss global developments. That created the idea for many in the Western world that the two powers are seeking to form a military alliance.
It does not correspond with reality at all. We are not creating any military alliance with China. Yes, we have cooperation in this sphere of military technical interaction. We are not hiding this. Everything is transparent. There is nothing secret. We have military cooperation. We conduct drills not only with China, but even with other countries as well.
In a statement following their Moscow summit, the two leaders said their relations are not bloc-like, confrontational, or directed at third countries. The statement comes as Washington has recently said that it fears Beijing could arm Russia in its war with Ukraine. Moscow, however, has time and again reiterated that its stance in Ukraine is defensive in nature against the aggressive West. This is why Russia has pointed its fingers at the West for funneling billions of dollars worth of ammunition to Ukraine. Moscow argues that the help from the Western alliance to Kiev does pose a threat to its national security. Putin, however, has assured that Russia will not be outgunned in the war despite all the Western interference. Putin's remarks come at a time when China and Russia already share a common concern of encirclement by the United States and NATO. Many say Russia sees NATO's eastward expansion as an existential threat, which according to them has been the main reason for its war with Ukraine. In West Asia, the United States maintains its presence in countries like Iraq and Syria under the pretext of fighting terrorism. But the reality on the ground indicates that Washington is only after plundering their natural riches. Washington's presence in the West Asia region also serves as a goal to maintain its encirclement of Russia. In East Asia, China is concerned that the United States is trying to create what it calls Indo-Pacific NATO by signing a string of defense agreements from the Philippines to Australia. From its military buildup on the Korean Peninsula to providing military assistance to Taiwan, it seems that Putin's assessment about Western powers recruiting allies from across the world to create an axis is closer to the reality. That can be significantly highlighted after NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg paid a visit to Japan and South Korea, where he stressed the Atlantic Alliance working closely with partners in the Indo-Pacific region. He also urged the nations to support Ukraine with more military support. Quite contrary, China has recently helped broker a diplomatic rapprochement between Iran and Saudi Arabia after a seven-year break and announced its decision to bring an end to the war in Ukraine. This not only shows there is no West-like military alliance between Washington and Beijing, but also indicates that countries in the East are seeking a peaceful resolution to the world's crises unless their national security is threatened. From a different perspective, an alliance between America's two greatest strategic and military foes would not be as bad, given that there is high potentiality to shift the global order.
March 26th marks the 8th anniversary of the Saudi war on Yemen, a conflict which started after Riyadh, leading a coalition of nine countries from West Asia and North Africa, launched an intervention to reinstate Saudi-backed former president Abd Rabbu Mansour Hadi after he was ousted by the Yemeni Ansarullah movement. According to UN figures, the war has so far claimed the lives of hundreds of thousands of people and brought the country's vital infrastructure to the brink of collapse. The war has also displaced millions of people. Riyadh and its allies also imposed a crippling blockade on Yemen, which has consequently caused a dire humanitarian crisis, with millions of children suffering from malnutrition and diseases like cholera. In a recent report, the United Nations expressed concern that it could be forced to slash support for children in Yemen without a funding boost. The UN Children's Agency said more than 540,000 under the age of 5 are suffering life-threatening severe acute malnutrition, with one child continuing to die every 10 minutes from preventable causes. UNICEF said if funding is not received, the agency might be forced to scale down its vital assistance, adding that the children of Yemen should be able to look to the future with hope, not fear. Peter Hawkins, UNICEF's representative in Yemen, said we called on all parties to help us deliver that hope by committing to the Yemeni people and pulling a country and a weary population back from the brink. But given all the sufferings by the Yemeni people, the war has stopped well shy of all its goals, despite killing hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and turning Yemen into the scene of the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Not only the war has not stopped, but the West's all-out support for Saudi Arabia has even exacerbated the situation and diminished prospects for peace. While Saudi Arabia maintains its blockade on Yemen, the humanitarian situation there is deteriorating day after day. This comes in light of the silence of the international community in dealing with the human catastrophe there. The current situation in Yemen questions the role of world countries in bringing the years-long deadly conflict to an end. Some countries have made efforts to help decrease the sufferings of the Yemeni people by sending humanitarian aid to the war-torn country or facilitate intra-Yemen talks to end the conflict. However, a sustainable political settlement in Yemen requires a more comprehensive approach. With the United Nations working with Yemeni parties and also regional and international stakeholders, there are hopes that the devastating conflict could soon be over. As long as a ceasefire is concerned, although a truce agreed between warring sides in April 2022 has largely been held, the UN Secretary-General's Special Envoy for Yemen says the military situation in Yemen is fragile. Hans Grundberg says the truce can only be a stepping stone, adding that the UN urgently needs to build on what was achieved by the truce and work towards a nationwide ceasefire and an inclusive political settlement to end the conflict in Yemen. Grundberg says now that Iran and Saudi Arabia have finally clinched an agreement to restore diplomatic relations and reopen embassies and missions, the warring parties need to seize the opportunity to take the decisive steps towards peace. He says momentum to end the conflict in Yemen has been renewed by a deal between Saudi Arabia and Iran to resume ties. This can be clearly highlighted in comments made by Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, who has numerously reaffirmed Tehran's support for any dialogue which would help promote peace and stability in Yemen. The top diplomat says the Islamic Republic supports intra-Yemeni talks to find a political solution to the crisis in the war-wracked Arab country. Even former Saudi officials have expressed optimism that the agreement between Tehran and Riyadh will be a game-changer for West Asia. All in all, what seems to be of high significance is that ending the years-long Yemen conflict requires patience, long-term perspective, courage, and leadership. According to the UN Special Envoy for Yemen, much has been achieved over the past year, and now it is time to take the next step.
France is in a crisis mode. Police have clashed with protesters angry at President Macron's controversial pension reforms. Unions claim 3.5 million people turned out across the country, while authorities suggested the figure was much lower at just under 1.1 million. In the capital, Paris, union leaders said that a record 800,000 people took part in the march throughout the city to demand that the government drop the fiercely contested change. Interior Minister Gérald Darmanin said dozens of police officers had been injured and dozens of people were arrested across the country. Earlier, workers blocked access to a terminal at the Charles de Gaulle airport, forcing some travelers to get there on foot. French trade unions have called for fresh nationwide strikes and protests amid growing anger over the government's unpopular pension reforms. Trade unions have blamed the government for, quote, the explosive situation in the country. They also asked workers to continue protesting against President Emmanuel Macron's pension reforms.
For us, 10, 12 years ago, the previous pension reform was already unacceptable. What we want is a retirement age at 60 years old and 55 years old for those with hard-working conditions. And at one point, all these demands have to be expressed on the ground. And if we have to go beyond the demands set by the inter-unions, then this is what we will do.
Train and air travel was disrupted, while teachers were among many professions to walk off the job. Plumes of smoke were seen rising from burning piles of debris, blocking traffic on a highway near Toulouse in southwestern France. And strikes briefly blocked roads in other cities as well. Police also fired tear gas at some protesters in several other cities and used water cannon against others in Rennes in the northwest. Protests against the measures have raged since January.
The only thing he could say to appease the anger would be that he renounces reform, that there won't be any reform, that he respects the fact that the vast majority of the people don't want it, and that he regrets the way it happened. It was, most probably won't be that way, so I think we are in a deep crisis that will linger on for weeks and maybe months.
The French President Emmanuel Macron has said the legislation, which his government pushed through the French Parliament without a vote last week, would come into force by year-end, despite escalating tensions. The protests are the most serious challenge to Macron since the Yellow Vest revolt 4 years ago.
We may be at the beginning of a new Gilets Jaunes, Yellow Vest movement, absolutely, because there is no democratic way out. The only thing that could avoid that would be a decision by the Supreme Court, the French Supreme Court, to overrule the law and to, you know, reset the legislative process. It has the power to do this. This is the only hope we have to avoid a major crisis.
Opinion polls show two-thirds of French people are against Macron's pension reform and the decision to push it through without a parliamentary vote. Since December, Macron has suffered a substantial drop of 8 points, and he now sees only 28% satisfied and 70% dissatisfied. Macron's government has shunned Parliament to impose the unpopular pension reforms via a special constitutional power, the so-called Article 49.3, which provides that the government can pass a bill without a vote at the National Assembly, the lower house of Parliament, after a deliberation at a cabinet meeting.
I think this was a denial of democracy. The government passed a law for which a majority of French people were against. The National Assembly was against it, using the 49.3 as a scornful of French public opinion. Macron was elected with no majority. He was elected against the Front National. We did not give him a mandate to pass these reforms, which are unjust.
Procedure has been used in the past by various governments, but this time, it's prompting a lot of criticism because of the massive public opposition to the proposed reform. The proposed changes include raising the retirement age from 62 to 64 and increasing the number of years people must make contributions to receive a full state pension. The reforms were at the heart of President Emmanuel Macron's re-election campaign last year, but are proving deeply unpopular. The government insists the reform plan is essential to ensure the French pension system does not run out of money.
So yes, there aren't 100 solutions if we want the pension system to be balanced. It no longer is. And the more we wait, the more it will get worse. And so this reform is necessary. And I say this to the French people, I don't enjoy doing this, I would have preferred not to do this, but it's also because of a sense of responsibility that I express my commitment to do this in front of you.
But many see the changes, such as raising the retirement age, as unfair to people who started working young.
I'm already disadvantaged in terms of my quarterly periods, given my redundancy, given the retirement age, which is being pushed back again and again. I've had a very, very long career. I started at 15, and I feel like I'll never get there.
option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
The soaring inflation rate in the United States and Europe was triggered by the war in Ukraine that broke out last year. Wall Street's top strategist expects the US economy to enter recession by the middle of this year, with corporate profits falling and unemployment rising. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Agence France-Presse has covered this story and tells us more. A new survey citing economists has predicted the United States is poised to enter recession this year and face high inflation well into 2024. More than two-thirds of respondents to the National Association for Business Economics survey saw inflation remaining above 4% in the United States at the end of the year. The organization said in a statement the survey summarized the responses of 217 National Association of Business Economics members and was conducted between 2nd to 10th of March. It comes as the U.S. Federal Reserve has raised interest rates by 4.75 percentage points in a bid to tackle soaring inflation in the country, which touched a record level last year amid the collapse of several major American banks. Silvergate Bank, Silicon Valley Bank, Signature Bank and First Republic Bank all crashed within a couple of weeks, plunging the financial markets into turmoil. U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said on Thursday, 23rd of March, that the government used tools to act quickly to prevent contagion and was prepared to take additional actions if warranted amid the banking crisis. Janet Yellen claimed, "Our top priority is to protect the health of the U.S. economy. 2 weeks ago, we learned of problems at two banks, and that could have significant impacts on the broader banking system and the American economy. We took action to protect all depositors at the two failed institutions and provide additional liquidity for banks. This was designed to mitigate risks to the banking sector." Janet Yellen further noted that the owners and shareholders of the failed banks are not being protected by the government and the losses due to the collapse of the banks would not be covered using taxpayers' money. The recent quarter of a percentage point rise in the interest rates by the Federal Reserve's 9th consecutive rate rise and the highest rate since 2007. Just a year ago, interest rates were close to zero. Meanwhile, international markets have been closely watching the U.S. Federal Reserve's moves and mounting stress in the U.S. banking sector. On Wednesday, 22nd of March, European Central Bank President Christine Lagarde warned that financial tensions in the wake of the banking crisis may hit the eurozone. Christine Lagarde warned, "Inflation is still high and uncertainty around its path ahead has increased. This makes a robust strategy going forward essential." Recently, the European Central Bank decided to raise its interest rate by a further 50 basis points, shrugging off the turmoil in the banking markets. The Bank of England has increased its interest rate repeatedly in the last 2 years, raising it 11 times to 4.25 percentage point now. The Bank of England says the increase in interest rate is part of the British government's measures to curb inflation that hit its highest levels since 1982. According to some economists, the rise in interest rates will inevitably increase pressure on many Britons already being squeezed by soaring inflation and the worsening cost of living crisis that is expected to continue until 2028. The American newspaper The Hill has also covered this story and tells us more. According to a new survey, the public's trust in the US banking industry sharply dropped in the aftermath of the collapse of four prominent banks recently and their effects on the market. An opinion poll released recently found only 10% of respondents said they have a great deal of confidence in US banking and financial institutions. That's down from 22% who said they did in a 2020 opinion poll. Almost 60% of respondents said in the recent poll that they had only some confidence in banking, while 30% said they had hardly any confidence. In a breakdown of responses from various industries included in the survey, only Congress had a lower percentage say they have a great deal of confidence in the institution. The lack of trust in banking was bipartisan, as only 10% of Democrats and 8% of Republicans said they have a great deal of confidence in the banking sector. Silicon Valley Bank collapsed recently after it did not have enough cash on hand to fulfill withdrawal requests and needed to sell assets, leading to a bank run. Signature Bank, which focuses on cryptocurrency, and also two other banks crashed just a few days later. The federal government stepped in to protect all deposits from customers, even if an account surpasses the $250,000 limit that the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation protects to try to calm customers in the market. The country's largest banks also bailed out First Republic Bank, which is based in San Francisco, California, to the tune of $30 billion, as many of its depositors moved their money to larger institutions. Pollsters also found bipartisan agreement that government regulation of financial institutions is inadequate. Just more than half of Republicans said so, and 63% of Democrats agreed. Only 15% of all respondents said government regulations is too much. The Associated Press has also covered this story and tells us more. According to a new survey, less than 30% of the American public are confident that they can keep up with their expenses as inflation continues to impact the U.S. economy. The results of an opinion poll conducted by the NORC Center for Public Affairs Research at the University of Chicago and released on Friday, 24th of March, showed that only 29% of adults said they're extremely or very confident that they can keep up with expenses, marking a drop from the 45% who said so as inflation began to take effect in October of 2021. Pollsters also found that the percentage of adults who are confident they could find a job if they wanted to fell from 36% to 26%, and those who are confident they could afford to pay an unexpected medical expense fell from 33% to 23%. About 40% of respondents said they are somewhat confident they can keep up with the expenses, while 29% said they're not very or not at all confident. About three-quarters of respondents said their household expenses are higher than they were a year ago, while a third said their debt now is higher. Almost half said their household savings were lower compared to a year ago. Still, just more than a third said their personal finances majorly contribute to their stress levels, while half said they minorly contribute. A little more than a half also said they consider their financial situation to be good. The results come as inflation remains high in the United States. The U.S. Federal Reserve has aggressively raised interest rates as part of its attempts to lower inflation under its target of 2%. But some economic experts and politicians have expressed concerns that the U.S. Federal Reserve's moves could cause an economic downturn.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Here is a part of the speech delivered on March 21, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Nowruz. I deem it necessary to raise two essential points which are related to knowledge-based companies. One point is that we do have knowledge-based companies, but they must increase in number. The second point is that we are able to do this. At present, we have a little less than 7,000 knowledge-based companies. There are around 6,600 to 6,700 knowledge-based companies in the country. And out of these, around 4,500 companies are production companies. The rest do the public work and the like. These companies create about 300,000 direct jobs. This is a noteworthy number. Of course, the people whom I asked and who provided answers said that it is more than 300,000 jobs. They guessed that they have created about 320,000 direct jobs in the year 1400. Indirect jobs are much more than this. I asked them, how many more of these companies can be established in the year 1401? And they answered that 30% maximum. I'm not satisfied. I believe that 30% is not a desirable percentage for the country as it cannot satisfy the needs of the country. I expect officials to increase them by 100%. In other words, the companies should double in number, as a result of which 300,000 direct jobs will turn into 600,000 direct jobs in the year 1401. At present, we have a little less than 7,000 knowledge-based companies. There are around 6,600 to 6,700 knowledge-based companies in the country. And out of these, around 4,500 companies are production companies. The rest do the public work and the like. These companies create about 300,000 direct jobs. This is a noteworthy number. Of course, the people whom I asked and who provided answers said that it is more than 300,000 jobs. They guess that they have created about 320,000 direct jobs in the year 1400. Indirect jobs are much more than this. I ask them, how many more of these companies can be established in the year 1401? And they answered that 30% maximum. I'm not satisfied. I believe that 30% is not a desirable percentage for the country as it cannot satisfy the needs of the country. I expect officials to increase them by 100%. In other words, the companies should double in number, as a result of which 300,000 direct jobs will turn into 600,000 direct jobs in the year 1401. Of course, this should not cause us to establish a company and name it a knowledge-based company, while it is not really knowledge-based. No, we should really establish knowledge-based companies. Our officials should show determination and make it happen, particularly in sectors which lag behind others, such as the agricultural sector, as previously mentioned. Knowledge-based companies working in agriculture comprise 4% of the knowledge-based companies. Only 4% of them work in agriculture, despite the fact that the agriculture sector is of such importance. As I mentioned before, agriculture is important. So is livestock. The country must definitely achieve complete security and self-sufficiency in basic food products. We must achieve self-sufficiency in the supply of wheat and animal feed, corn, barley, and the like, and the main ingredients for the production of oil. We must certainly achieve self-sufficiency in the production of corn, barley, and the rest of products, which are referred to as basic products. And it is possible to do so.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The country is large and there is ample ground for work. We have fertile plains in different parts of the country. A few years ago, I encouraged officials to do something in Khuzestan. It was done to some extent in Khuzestan, Ilam and Sistan. Of course, it was not done to the extent that had been promised, but it was good anyway. This can be developed. This can be done. We have fertile plains and they must be utilized for the supply of basic products. Let me mention that once the Honorable President Mr. Raisi said to me in one of his foreign trips, the officials of that country said that they would buy watermelon, tomatoes and the like in whatever numbers we produce. Mr. Raisi said to them, but you yourselves have good lands, water and so many agricultural resources. You have fertile lands. Why do you want to buy watermelon and tomatoes from us? One of the officials answered, we do not use those lands for tomatoes and watermelon. Rather, they are used for the production of wheat, corn, and forage. This is correct. Of course, I'm not saying that we must not plant watermelon, vegetable, tomatoes, and the like. All these are necessary, but we must primarily dedicate the resources that exist in the country to important and basic food products and other fundamental goods. We must be able to produce as much as possible in these areas.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
Think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
world with reporters.
The margins were slim, the result momentous. Hamza Yousaf, a Muslim of Pakistani and Kenyan descent, becoming leader of the Scottish National Party after a bruising leadership campaign.
It is hard for me to find the words to describe just how honoured I am to be entrusted by our membership of the SNP to be the party's next leader and to be on the cusp of being our country's next First Minister.
The party he leads has a slim majority in the Scottish Parliament and has been working in coalition with the Progressive Green Party, for whom Yousaf, who has pledged continuity with his Liberal predecessor Nicola Sturgeon's era, is perhaps the right successor, compared to Economy Minister Kate Forbes, whose campaign got off to a rocky start over her socially conservative views.
I think there'd be a sigh of relief because I think if Kate Forbes, who got a far higher vote than was expected, but if Kate Forbes had won, then the Greens were not, had said they were not going to serve under her. So there's a sigh of relief that the coalition will continue.
The new First Minister faces major challenges, though. Record-high National Health Service waiting times under him as Health Minister. Nicola Sturgeon's education promises yet to be fulfilled. And the UK government's blocking of a cross-party act of the Scottish Parliament on gender self-ID, which exposed deep divisions within the SNP, plus the issue of Scottish independence.
As First Minister, Hamza Yousaf has promised to lead for all in a country of 5.5 million. Yet despite the country being stuck around 50-50 on the question of independence from the UK and of Westminster, he has pledged to make it happen.
The last unsuccessful independence referendum was held in 2014, and the most recent attempt at holding a second one without the consent of Westminster was struck down by the UK's Supreme Court.
A lot of independent supporters, not just SNP members, feel frustrated. There have been constant promises, yes, there'll be a referendum, constant promises of a big campaign which never materialised. People are becoming frustrated, and I think Hamza, as First Minister, is going to have to address that.
Outgoing First Minister Nicola Sturgeon tendered her resignation to the UK King on Tuesday. It remains to be seen if her successor will make her the last one. Saeed Bourza, London.
A vigil has been held in Gaza to condemn the spike in Israeli violations of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the West Bank. Over the past few days, and with the beginning of the holy month of Ramadan, dozens of Israeli forces stormed the vicinity of the compound of Al-Aqsa Mosque. They assaulted and blockaded Muslim worshippers and forced them out of the holy site, paving the way for Israeli far-right extremists to enter the mosque. That prompted Palestinians and resistance factions to reiterate their readiness to defend Al-Aqsa and repeat the 2021 Operation Sword Al-Quds if the Al-Aqsa status quo is violated.
The Palestinian used to just look at the situation in the West Bank and Al-Aqsa Mosque. These violations crossed the red line and the Palestinian people began to lose their patience. The Palestinian resistance has something to say if the occupation regime crosses our red line.
Palestinians and Muslims reject the temporal and spatial division of the Al-Aqsa Mosque between Muslims and Jews. This is while Israel keeps violating the internationally agreed status quo of the mosque. Ramadan every year witnesses Israeli attacks against Palestinians gathered in the holy place. In 2021, the expulsion of Palestinian families from their homes in Al-Quds and the Israeli raids on Al-Aqsa Mosque during the holy month of Ramadan led to an 11-day incursion on Gaza. More than 260 Palestinians were killed during the assault, including 67 children and 41 women. Over 2,000 Palestinians were injured and many more internally displaced.
Our message to the Israeli occupation is that breaching the sanctity of Al-Aqsa Mosque puts Israel on the verge of a collapse. Because our people will never remain silent over these violations, nor will they accept the temporal division of Al-Aqsa.
A surge in Israeli settler violence and military raids on Palestinian towns have claimed the lives of more than 90 Palestinians since the start of this year. That makes 2023 the deadliest year in decades in the occupied East Al-Quds and the West Bank.
We in Gaza are telling you that you can count on us. We support you in each and every step of operation you take against the Israeli occupation regime. We salute your struggle and reiterate our steadfastness toward our land. We will never leave our land.
There are concerns that tensions in the occupied territories would escalate as Israeli forces and settlers continue their attacks on Palestinians and violate their sanctities in clear defiance of calls to stop the violence.
The repeated Israeli attacks against the Palestinians in the West Bank and the regime's flagrant violations of the Holy Al-Aqsa Mosque during the fasting month of Ramadan have been met with strong condemnations here in Gaza, where people express their unwavering support for Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque.
The United Nations headquarters in Geneva once again played host to the annual Human Rights Council session on Monday, where the UN Special Rapporteur to Iran released a report on women's rights situation inside the Islamic Republic. Predictably, his views sparked major disputes with Iran's delegation over accusations of mistreatment of women in recent months following Western-backed anti-Iran riots.
Advocacy for human rights is increasingly mistaken by some states and human rights mandate holders for their unwarranted and egotistic purposes, abusing the human rights mechanisms to single out and target those nations with independent foreign policy is void of any added value for protection of human rights.
As the envoys battled it out, two Iranian onlookers had a very real story of abuse, which had been largely ignored until now. Manager Safiyari and Elham Jalizavi, two Iranian nationals who suffered horrifically following terrorist attacks on Iranian soil. The culprits, notorious anti-Iran terrorist group the MKO, an obscure cult organization which currently receives significant Western support and even maintains a presence at the UN itself via NGOs.
By providing them asylum, Western countries violated the 1951 Convention, enabling them to carry on all their human rights violations, which has in turn led to our rights being violated.
Safiyari was left wheelchair-bound at 17 after an MKO bomb attack targeted a market in 1985. Jalizavi was just 15 when her father was killed in their home by an MKO mortar attack in 1991. These are just two examples of the countless Iranian victims of MKO aggression. With the help of a sympathetic non-governmental organization, the Association for Defending Victims of Terrorism, their calls for justice have now reached the heart of the UN.
The MKO are a cult who commit these acts. Their members have been duped into cooperating with them. They've also been brainwashed. Their families, too, have suffered as a result. They, too, have fallen victim to the MKO.
They should be tried in court, not allowed to come here and claim innocence. We have even filed a lawsuit with French courts because many members live in France. But unfortunately, the courts voted in their favour.
Despite past recognition of the MKO as terrorist organisation in the Western world, the US and its allies have performed a U-turn, now promoting them as legitimate opposition to the Islamic Republic, despite their many crimes against Iranian civilians.
The relationship between the Islamic Republic and the United Nations have gone through strained times, but it seems as if the UN is seemingly happy to continue providing a platform for anti-Iran terrorist organizations such as this. And as long as they do, it'll be hard to believe that ordinary Iranians will ever be able to fully trust this international institution. Robert Carter, Geneva.
Quranic verses and anti-Israeli and U.S. slogans rank high in this year's National Day of Resilience demonstration in the capital Sana'a, where protesters celebrated what they called 9 years of successful resistance against the Saudi-led war, which began back in March 26, 2015. Yemen's Supreme Political Council leader, Mohammed Ali al-Houthi, who was present at the demonstration, said the armed resistance against all enemies of Yemen will continue until every inch of Yemeni land is liberated from foreign presence.
We must protect our resistance effort and continue to counter this enemy. We must march forward together and confront this enemy. We must focus more on the battlefront and prepare for it now more than ever before. We must support our Ministry of Defense, which is equipped with men who have the hearts of lions, men who will teach the enemy a lesson they will never forget.
When Saudi Arabia launched its war back in 2015, it said it would destroy all heavy weapons possessed by Ansar Allah and force them to withdraw from the Yemeni capital. What has happened, however, is quite the opposite. The Ansar Allah movement has managed to win the battle across the board, developing sophisticated weapons and taking over more territory. They've also managed to win the hearts and minds of the majority of the people in the north.